Virginia. And this is the dreaded morning of November 1st, 1765, the day the Stamp Act is to go into effect. But here before the House of Burgesses is a seething crowd determined that the act shall not go into effect. These angry colonists are face to face with the loaded muskets of Governor Fauquier's militia, drawn up across the square. The guards are quite as determined as the protesting crowd and ready for anything. The people have been waiting here since dawn now for the arrival of George Mercer, the new tax collector sent from England by King George III, with orders to enforce the Stamp Act, no matter how vehemently the colonists protest. Whether he'll be able to do so in the face of the angry mood of the colonists remains to be seen. Anything is possible. George Mercer is a native of Virginia and was once regarded as a neighbor and friend. But he arrives today...
November 1st, 1765, Williamsburg, Virginia. The American colonists challenge the enforcement of the English Stamp Act. You are there.
The people of Williamsburg enact the prologue to the American Revolution a decade before the shot that was heard round the world. CBS takes you back 185 years to the morning when the colonists rose up against the Stamp Act, the symbol of British autocracy and parliamentary dictation. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. With all the modern facilities of radio present and CBS newsmen reporting from the scene...
You are there!
You are there is based on historical fact and quotation. And now...
November 1st, 1765. The green before the Capitol in Williamsburg, Virginia, and Bill Leonard.
From the very first, there's been strong and often violent resistance to the Stamp Act throughout the American colonies. It was here only 5 months ago, on May 30th, 1765, that the first public opposition to this tax was hurled at the English Parliament and King George III by Williamsburg's House of Burgesses. A young lawyer, Mr. Patrick Henry, who's standing beside me now, introduced a series of resolutions condemning the Stamp Act, and the House of Burgesses passed them. These Virginia resolutions, as you know, started a fire of protest against the royal government that has swept over the colonies in America to such an extent that today active demonstrations are shaking the traditional calm of these English colonies. Demonstrations that may even result in mob violence. Later in the course of this broadcast, we hope to call in our correspondents in Boston, in New York, and perhaps other points for a roundup of events at those places. But now, Mr. Patrick Henry has consented to repeat, at the risk of personal danger and possibly imprisonment, I might add, the remarks he made last May in the House of Burgesses.
Those were very mild remarks to what I can really say.
Your remarks, however, were considered far from mild, Mr. Henry.
They appear to have been strong enough for me to have been called an incendiary and a traitor. Traitor! It is not I who am the traitor, but rather those aristocratic ostriches sitting in the House of Commons in London with their heads in their purses and their hands in the pockets of the common people.
By the common people, Mr. Henry, I presume you mean the colonists here in America upon whom the tax will fall.
Not them alone. In my resolution, I said that this tax will destroy British as well as American freedom. And I meant just that. This act puts a tax on every broadside, newspaper, and pamphlet, every bill, note, deed, and bond, every lease, every license, insurance policy, ship's clearance papers, why, even college diplomas. This tax strikes at the very heart of our commerce, down to the smallest private transaction. Now, no proud people can accept such interference with their affairs, especially when imposed without their consent by royal prerogative men who live in comfort 3,000 miles away.
Yes, but how does that affect the people in England who, as you say, are 3,000 miles away?
It affects them very directly and where they are most sensitive. American merchants already refuse to import or buy goods made in England. And as a result, there is a depression in British business and a depression in employment. Therefore, I say that the people in England may suffer even more from this tax than we will.
Well, Mr. Henry, we tried to get a copy of the full resolution that you made last May, remember, in the House of Burgesses, but we've been having some difficulty, and I wonder...
Of course you've been having difficulty. The heart of my resolutions were expunged from the journals, the very next day after they've been passed, expunged by a vote of some of our timid Virginia lawmakers who fear the fury of King George. But we will convince them, too.
Mr. Henry, you said you'd repeat your resolution against the Stamp Act for us here on CBS.
Of course I will. I said that the General Assembly of this colony shall have the sole right and power to levy taxes on its inhabitants.
And that's when the Speaker of the House cried out treason.
Yes, and that is when I said to the House, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles the First his Cromwell, and George the Third may profit by their example. If this be treason, I said, make the most of it!
Do you think, sir, that George Mercer will profit by the example of this demonstration and decide against enforcement of the...
George Mercer is merely a dupe of George the Third. He does not have an altogether free choice in the matter. The citizens will help him to reach that decision. Here, today.
Thank you, Mr. Patrick Henry. There's still no sign of the coach bringing George Mercer to Williamsburg, but there is a lady standing beside me. She's holding a small boy by the hand, and she looks as if she took exception to Mr. Henry's remark.
Well, of course I do. All this wild talk, all these demonstrations, it's disgusting.
Would you tell us your name, please?
Agatha Sterrett. This is my son, Charles.
Hello there. Mrs. Sterrett, I take it that you're not supporting the citizens here in this demonstration.
All I want is peace. Nothing but peace.
Are you in favor of the Stamp Act, then?
Oh, why must people always be for something or against something while children suffer and food is taken out of their very mouths? I just want peace. Ever since these protests started, my husband hasn't brought a shilling into the house.
Well, what does your husband do for a living, Mrs. Sterrett?
He's in business. Or he was.
What sort of business is that?
In the import-export trade. Our home's here in Williamsburg.
I see, and since so many merchants have signed non-importation agreements and refused to trade in English goods, your husband's business has been affected, is that it?
Affected? It just doesn't exist anymore. How am I to feed my children? How can I send them to school with tattered clothes? Oh, these demonstrations, this stupid business. Where? Some people are even saying there will be a call to arms. Just imagine, armed resistance against the king. I say what we need are some cool heads to talk peace, to get business going again. Charles, come back here, come back!
Thank you, Mrs. Sterrett. I'd venture to say that Mrs. Sterrett represents a pretty sizable body of public opinion. While the crowd around me is literally seething with unrest, the fact is that a number of people would just like to see this whole conflict peaceably resolved one way or the other so they can resume their normal lives. But the chances are that they'll not see this happen without... George Mercer has arrived. His carriage has just come into sight. It's coming down Duke of Gloucester Street toward the Capitol here, and the crowd is shouting and booing. Some people are brandishing clubs and pitchforks. Others are shaking their fists at him. The militia's having trouble holding the crowd in check. People are straining against the governor's guard, trying to push their way through to the carriage. These people are shouting, "Down with Mercer," and the slogan, "Liberty, property, and no stand." The carriage is going down the path cleared by the guard. No, the crowd has broken through the line of militiamen. They've broken through and they surround the carriage. And now they've forced it to a stop a few yards from us here, very close to us, before the steps of the Capitol. Now Governor Fauquier, the royal governor of Virginia, is rushing out of the Capitol, heading toward the carriage. Now the door of the carriage is open. Someone's wrenched it open. George Mercer is crossed inside. From my position here before the Capitol, I can see him quite clearly. There's a look of stunned surprise on his face. I'd say that he had no inkling that he was going to get this kind of reception. The crowd's milling around his carriage, shouting and threatening, but no one has touched Colonel Mercer yet. They're busy, too busy struggling with the guards who are trying to reestablish their lines around the carriage. Governor Fauquier is pushing his way through the crowd now, shouting for quiet. The guards are beginning to force the crowd back. They've reformed their lines, pressing the crowd back away from the carriage. I must say that the guards are not using their muskets. They're not getting rough. They push with their hands and try to block off the crowd with their bodies. They seem to be under orders not to shoot or harm the colonists. Governor Fauquier has pushed his way through the crowd now, and he stands in the clear space near the carriage, protected by the guards from the angry crowd.
For the governor!
Shouting for quiet again,
listen
and
for me.
People here are beginning to calm down. We're trying to get as close, to their carriage as possible in order to hear what the governor has to say. Will you excuse me, please? I've got to get through. I'm from CBS here. Let me see. Thank you. I'm close to the inner circle of the crowd now. Just behind the line of guards, you can probably hear Governor Fouquet trying to get quiet, and successfully, too. The people here are quieting down, except for an occasional shout at George Mercer. The royal governor, very popular and greatly respected by most Virginians, which is probably the chief reason that this crowd is stopping to listen to him now. Governor Fouquet has his hand up.
Citizens of Virginia, George Mercer is here under orders from His Majesty King George III. I can therefore permit no interference with his person. He has my official protection, and I must order you to disperse, to return to your homes, to let him pass in peace.
Wait! Governor Fouquet has told the crowd to disperse, to go to their homes. You can hear their answer. They're not moving.
Wait! Listen! Fellow Virginians, listen to me. It's senseless to protest this way, to endanger life and property, when George Mercer is simply carrying out orders that are not his own making. He has no alternative but to follow those orders.
He has! Tell him to burn the stamps! We don't want the stamps!
Burn the stamps! Burn the stamps! Please, gentlemen, Colonel Mercer has just arrived from Ireland. He knows nothing of your sentiments or of the issues involved in this matter. Is that a tiring journey, a long journey? Give him rest. Give him until Friday to decide whether...
No! Giving us rest!
One moment, please. Please, gentlemen, let us not have violence done to an old friend.
No friend of ours! He's no friend of ours!
This is the first that our friend George Mercer is acquainted with your disapproval of the Stamp Act. Give him time to determine the real sentiments of his countrymen.
Down the act.
Let him speak now. He will speak. But give him at least time to nourish himself with a hot cup of coffee. I personally promise you, citizens, that George Mercer will have a statement for you in a quarter of an hour. A quarter of an hour, no longer. And you know I'll keep my word. Now let us go to the coffee house. Make way, please.
Crowd. He's going to try to walk right through that angry mass of people to escort Colonel Mercer to the Raleigh Tavern. The crowd chanting, one and all, stick together, one and all. I can't predict what will happen here, but nobody can deny that the governor is an extremely courageous man. Now the guards have cleared a lane through this crowd, and the governor and Mercer are slowly walking through. No one's made a move toward them yet. They're about halfway through the gauntlet. Now some of the people are waving their clubs and pitchforks, and the governor or Mercer. The governor seems to be winning this battle of nerves. Now they're clear of the crowd. They pass right through and are headed across Capitol Square toward the Raleigh Tavern. They pass through this angry crowd unharmed, not a hair cut. The crowd is waiting here, discussing the events of the past few moments. They appear no less angry, no less determined than they were when George Mercer first arrived. That fact must be clear to any observer. And while we wait for George Mercer's answer, one way or the other, let's go for a quick roundup of developments in other cities here in the English colony. First, for an analysis from Quincy Howe in our CBS studios, then to New York and Boston. Come in, Quincy Howe.
The British appear to have bitten off quite a bit more than they can chew. This is not only the considered opinion of many American colonists, many good Englishmen feel exactly the same way. The truth is that English opinion is split wide open. The landed nobles favor the Stamp Act. The merchants oppose it. The nobles want to collect taxes at any price. The merchants want to do business at any price. The French and Indian War left England with a national debt of between 130 and 140 million pounds. Who's going to pay for this? Well, British political leaders like George Grenville, First Lord of the Treasury, give this reply. The Englishman at home is heavily burdened with taxes already. Let's tax the Englishman in America. And that's what tax collector George Mercer is supposed to do, make the American colonists pay. The Stamp Act, of course, is not the first money measure Lord Grenville has aimed at American colonists. With last year's Sugar Act and Currency Act and this year's Quartering Act, His Majesty's government is digging deeper and deeper into the pockets of the American colonial. And it all adds up to a lot of trouble during this time of post-war economic stress. 9 months ago, when the English Parliament was debating the Stamp Act bill, nobody anticipated this kind of reaction. The English press hardly mentioned the Stamp Act debates at all. And no one, including colonial agents in London, men like Benjamin Franklin, looked for such violent opposition as we're now seeing here in America. And when Parliament passed the Stamp Act by a very great majority, 205-4 and only 49 against, well, that definitely committed the English to enforce the law at all costs. But the Americans now seem just determined to oppose the Stamp Act even to the point of violent uprising. That's the conflict we may see resolved here today. For the crucial action seems likely to take place here in Williamsburg, where George Mercer at this very moment ponders his next step. But the fever of violence is abroad in the land. So we take you now to New York and Ned Calmer for the picture there. Come in, Ned Calmer.
There's a crowd of about 2,000 people here at the waterfront on the tip of Manhattan Island, and the music you hear is no serenade. It's directed against the British ship that has been in New York Harbor now for almost a week. The ship is loaded with stamps, and the British officials seem to be hesitant about unloading them in the face of this demonstration. Now, I've asked one of the demonstrators to sing this song into our microphone so you can get the word. Are you ready now? Second largest city in America after Philadelphia, almost all commerce, or what's left of it, has been stopped for this parade and demonstration. A crowd of artisans and laborers dressed in long pantaloons and leather breeches bundled up on this cold November morning in fur-lined overcoats and coonskin hats are making things a little warmer for themselves. Not only are they burning officials in effigy, but they've torn down the wooden palisades around Bowling Green and made a bonfire. Demonstrators are moving now. Heading the parade is a huge placard with skull and bones, and the placard reads, "Stamp Act, the folly of England and the ruin of America." I have here at the microphone a man who's been nailing up these posters all over town.
That's right.
And now, sir, will you read for our listeners the words on one of these posters you're carrying?
Read them. I know them by heart. It says, "Warning. The first man that either distributes or makes use of stamp and paper, let him take care of his house and person and effect. Sign, Vox Populi. We dare."
And Vox Populi?
That's me and the rest of New York.
I see. Thank you, sir. Well, that's pretty much the sentiment here in New York right now. And we put you next to Boston and Larry Lesur. Through the windows of the Green Dragon Tavern here on the Boston waterfront, we can see the ships in the harbor displaying their colors at half-mast. They're mourning the first day of the enforcement of the Stamp Act. Early today, Sam Adams, as you may have heard, the leader of the Boston Liberty Boys, harangued the crowd with this statement, "The people shout, and their shout will be heard to the distant end of this continent." There are, however, other voices than the Liberty Boys of Sam Adams here in Boston. There's other voices, fewer to be sure, represent the other side of this conflict. And here at our microphone is Mr. Martin Howard, a lawyer of Newport, Rhode Island. Mr. Howard, I take it that you believe that the colonists ought to pay the tax without protest.
I do. The act was passed by Parliament, and every British subject must abide by the law.
But it's argued, sir, that the colonists have no representation in Parliament, and this tax is what Edmund Burke called taxation without representation.
Edmund Burke may be a native of England, but he talks like a Philadelphia lawyer. The colonists, like all Englishmen, are represented in the House of Commons. But a member of Parliament represents not only his own constituency, but all Englishmen everywhere. The colonists have all personal rights, including those of life, liberty, and estate. And these rights are secured to us by the common law, which is every subject's birthright, whether born in Great Britain, on the ocean, or in the colonies. And it is in this sense they enjoy all the rights and privileges of Englishmen.
But isn't the question here one of political rather than personal rights, sir? Is it your opinion that the colonists actually enjoy political rights?
Political rights? This rabble? They burn respected British officials in effigy. They burn down the house of the tax collector. They riot through the streets. How can such people be trusted with political rights? It's monstrous, monstrous. And now I beg you to excuse me, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Martin Howard. The riots that Mr. Howard spoke about referred to the parade this morning around the townhouse where the governor and his council hold office. The people carried effigies of British officials to the townhouse and shouted, "Liberty, property, no stamp." And they then proceeded to Andrew Oliver's house. He's the stamp master for Massachusetts. And as a result of some provocation, they say, destroyed the fences in front of his house, entered it, and then broke up the furniture. Nobody was hurt, however, and the action has not resulted in a practical resolution of this affair as of the present moment. The events in Williamsburg may well be the key ones in determining the outcome of the Stamp Act controversy. So back now to Williamsburg, Bill Leonard reporting.
George Mercer and Governor Fauquier are still debating. The promised 15 minutes are about up, and the tension increases by the second. We've moved our microphone to the Raleigh Tavern, where George Mercer is closeted with the governor and his council in the Daphne Room right next door. The crowd's made its way the two blocks from the Capitol to the street in front of the tavern here, and as many people as could squeeze in are now jammed into this little tavern. We're set up in the Apollo Room of the Raleigh, the most colorful room in this most colorful tavern in all Virginia. The band you hear playing in the background has certainly served to relieve some of the tension here. The Apollo Room, incidentally, takes its name from a room in the Devil's Tavern in London, which was frequented by Sir Walter Raleigh and Ben Jonson. Above the mantel across the room from me is a gilded motto, Hilaratus Sapienti et Boni Vitae Prolix, translating into something like jollity, the offspring of wisdom and good living. Good living in the colonies, it seems, will depend very much on Colonel Mercer's forthcoming statement. He's still not come out. Williamsburg, ordinarily a town of only 1,000 or 2,000, is swelled today by 4,000 or 5,000 visitors. It almost seems that most of them are in the Apollo Room here. They're crowded together as we await Mr. Mercer's decision. And as always in the Raleigh, there are assembled here merchants and traders, adventurers, planters, all sorts of people. Here at our microphone is a sea captain. He's Captain Stephen McCready, I think that's right, and he's agreed to be interviewed. Captain, what cargo are you carrying these days?
Only wine in my belly. I've been drinking some excellent Madeira here, but tea cargo, oh no, sir. Merchants have almost forgotten my ship since all this fuss over the Stamp Act.
What ports do you usually sail to?
Liverpool, Curacao, Genoa, Amsterdam. Wherever my cargo takes me, I tell you, sir, I've seen all kinds of foul weather. But I've yet to see a hurricane to match the one blowing up here in the colonies. But as far as cargo is concerned, me and every sea captain like me is becalmed. No cargo in Boston, no cargo in New York, no cargo in Philadelphia. Another month of this non-importation and my ship will sink with the weight of the barnacles growing on its bottom.
Captain, are there any ships moving at all?
Only a few for the West Indies trade, but most British trade has stopped. Stopped because stamp paper is not available for clearances and bills of lading. That fellow Mercer better come to his senses, or no one will be able to afford to buy even stamps, much less goods. Still, I've got a shilling or two for another bottle. Will you join me?
Thank you. I'd like to, Captain, but we're working here. But I expect that George Mercer will be coming out soon. From what I've been able to see here in Williamsburg, Captain McCready's views on business conditions are reasonably accurate. The bulletin board on the little porch in front of Raleigh Tavern is covered with all kinds of notices of auction sales of personal property. I'm going to move out to that porch in order to read off to you some of these notices and be ready for Governor Fauquier and Colonel Mercer when they address the crowd out front, as we expect they will. The crowd waiting here before the Raleigh Tavern extends far up and down Duke of Gloucester Street. Among them must certainly be some of the people who posted these auction sale notices here on the bulletin board. I see a notice of sale for a coach and 4 horses, and one for a house and a barn. There's one here for 6 Hereford cattle, and others for ships and taverns, shops, warehouses, slaves. Even household goods and clothing are for sale, just about everything. And if this continues, I... Just one...
Governor Folkey has just come out to the Daphne room. I can see through the doorway that he's motioned the band to stop playing. He's coming out to the porch here to address the crowd. This is the moment we've all been waiting for. Now he's raising both his hands and a hush is falling over the crowd here.
Gentlemen! Gentlemen! Mr. George Mercer is ready to make a statement. Mr. Mercer.
Colonel Mercer is slowly making his way through the door out to the porch. He looks very much troubled. He seems reluctant to speak, hesitating, but the crowd have their eyes on him. They're not pleading eyes, they're menacing eyes. He seems ready to speak now, and here he is.
Gentlemen, I arrived this morning to carry out my duty to enforce the Stamp Act. I do acknowledge that some little time before I left England, I heard of and saw some resolves which were said to be made by Mr. Patrick Henry in the House of Burgesses in Virginia. But as the authenticity of these resolves was disputed, I determined to know the real sentiments of my countrymen for myself. I know these sentiments now. And in view of them, I give you every assurance that I will not, directly or indirectly, by myself or my deputies, proceed in the execution of the Stamp Act.
The Stamp Act will not be enforced. Victory is victory here. Mr. Mercer will not enforce the Stamp Act. The crowd cheering wildly there. Well, they're carrying George Mercer on their shoulders. Parading him through the streets and he's laughing. Please, I suppose that he's considered an old friend again. Someone's beating a drum. The bells are ringing and perhaps we can hear them. Even above this din of celebration here from Bruton Park. William and Mary come. Tax collectors all over the colonies are certain to be resigning now. Boston, Eden Stone in Hartford, Zacharias Ford in Maryland, Henry Van Schaik in Albany. This is indeed a victory. A victory of the American colonists against oppressive measures, against British autocratic rule, a victory that will transfer power from an aristocratic minority to a democratic majority.
November 1st, 1765. The American colonists reject the Stamp Act and win their first great battle against autocratic rule, paving the way for ultimate independence. You are there.
You've been listening to the Stamp Act Rebellion in the series You Are There. Today's program was written by Joseph Liss, edited by Irving Gitlin, and directed by John Dietz. You Are There is produced by the CBS Documentary Unit under the supervision of Werner Michel. Agatha Sterrett was played by Hester Sundergaard. Paul Mann was Patrick Henry. Eric Dressler was George Mercer. And Ralph Bell was Martin Howard, the lawyer. Others in the cast were various members of the ensemble. You Are There is brought to you every fourth Sunday. The next broadcast will be heard Sunday, April 16th, at this same time over most of these same stations next month.
480 B.C., the pass at Thermopylae in ancient Greece, the heroic stand of Leonidas and 300 Spartans against the Persian invader. You are there.